Focus with Cassie McCullough on ABC Radio Sydney.
Well, right now we're in the middle of two election campaigns. The New South Wales one has officially begun and the federal one is well underway, even though the date hasn't been announced yet. And this means that we're in the midst of a big contest of ideas, policy debates, and it's all adversarial. All of that energy of the parties and the candidates is pitted against each other. And in the end, the loudest, most persuasive argument will come out on top. Well, what if there was another way? Perhaps there is. Professor David Farrell is an Irish political scientist. He's from the University College in Dublin, but he was also the research leader of the Irish Citizens Assembly and the research director of the Constitutional Convention. It recently made some pretty significant decisions. You're in Australia as a guest of the New Democracy Foundation. David, welcome to Australia.
Thank you very much.
Now, tell us, we saw this extraordinary event last year where Ireland, as we know, a very deeply Catholic community, voted for the freedom for women to have abortions. Describe for us what a fundamental change that was for the Irish community.
It was huge. I mean, you can't really exaggerate the importance of that particular vote. You know, we had a clause inserted into our constitution in 1983 banning abortion, recognising that the right to life of the unborn was equal to the right to life of the mother. And two-thirds of Irish voters in 1983 voted to put that into the constitution. In 2018, last year, two-thirds of Irish voters voted to get it back out. So that's how significant that was.
An almost 180-degree turnaround.
Exactly.
Before that, we also saw same-sex marriage being made legal and formal in Ireland as well. What process did you go through before those decisions were made? What part did this Irish Citizens Assembly play in those decisions?
Yeah, and this is the really important bit, isn't it? I mean, you know, the way you described in your introductory remarks about the adversarial nature of party politics is so familiar in the world over. This is unfortunately the way party politics can tend to operate. And so what we had, and I think most strongly in the case of our abortion referendum, was a situation where parties were divided, and they were divided internally. You had MPs against MPs on the issue of abortion. We had debate after debate over decades in the parliament and in civil society. We had referendums that tried to resolve this impasse relating to abortion, and it was just never being solved. And the ingredient that made the difference, and nobody I think now disputes that, was having a citizens' assembly at the start of the process. A random selection of regular citizens from across the country picked by an opinion poll company, spending 5 months in detailed discussion, listening to experts, listening to advocates, listening to personal testimonies from women, hearing from church leaders, dealing with protesters outside the venue where they were, you know, meeting for those 5 months. In a very reflective, calm, deliberative process, they looked at the complexities of the argument around abortion, the nuances, you know, what kind of abortion regime might one allow in the country. And they then made a very detailed report, a set of recommendations, which was fed back into the parliamentary process. And the politicians were persuaded by the evidence that they had before them.
Let's hear about that process, because 5 months is a long time.
Yeah.
So how many people were involved?
So 99 regular citizens, a Supreme Court judge chairing it, senior civil servants providing the support. It was all funded and run by the government. And they then heard from lots of people. I mean, there were over 13,000 submissions from members of the public. There were, you know, these were five long weekends of meetings.
So there were weekends.
Yes.
So you didn't have to remunerate people for loss of income.
No, exactly. And this is the point about this, because you want regular citizens to be able to give up the time to do it. So that's the deal. If you're going to do it, it's going to be a long weekend, but it's going to be a weekend. And there's going to be reading in between. And insofar as you can do it, please do the reading. And, you know, many of them will have done the reading, so they will have assimilated the knowledge. And by the end of those 5 months, you know, these guys knew the issue. They really understood what was going on.
So just so I'm clear, did they meet each weekend for 5 months or just at the end?
They met once a month.
Once a month?
For over 5 months.
And for a weekend, the entire weekend?
The entire weekend. And, you know, you had people who were coming up to Dublin on a Friday. We're not as big a country as you are, I know. But still, you had people who were going very long distances, and they would start at 9 o'clock on a Saturday morning and go right through to usually early afternoon on the Sunday, and then they'd go back home again. So this was a massive commitment by these people. Originally, they were only going to take 4 months, and midway through, they requested another
the extra
month.
Time.
Yeah.
So that actually, the commitment that what they made does point to the type of people that were part of this process, because simply to have made that commitment to that time and the travel means that they would have a very developed political sense, or at least maybe a sense of the moral importance of what they were doing. Is that problematic for the process? Does it sort of select in people who are likely to be engaged on a certain level politically?
There's always a danger, if one isn't careful, that you might get a skewed group in the room. I have to say, I don't see any evidence of that in this case. I mean, part of my role was to research those individuals and survey them and interview them. And they were coming from all walks of life, everything from truck drivers and students and grannies and you name it. They came from all backgrounds and, you know.
And devout Catholics?
Oh, yes, there were devout Catholics. I mean, to the extent that after the first weekend, the secretariat had to make sure that there were arrangements for those who wanted to go to Mass on the Sunday. So, yes, you had that mix. You had people who started the process who were very pro-life and those who were very pro-choice at the start, and there was quite a big bunch who were really not very sure about it.
Mm-hmm. And so what was the public's engagement with this? Were they invited to view the process, or was it deemed to be better done with some kind of remove from scrutiny of the public?
It's a really important question. So it's mixed, and the general pattern you'll find in all of these sort of processes is a mix of public plenary events where all the 99 are in the one room together listening to the experts or questioning the experts, and then these quiet deliberative periods when they're all in their round tables with trained facilitators, the cameras leave. But for the public plenary sessions, the cameras were in the room, so the Irish Parliament channel covered it. So
it was on TV.
It was on TV. It was, you know, so you could switch it on and watch it live if you wanted to. It was also available on the web. So the hotel that they used had very, very good Wi-Fi for that particular purpose. So they mixed the public with the private. All the documents they had were put up on the website. As I mentioned, all members of the public were invited to submit, and 13,000 did. And if you think about it, in that 5 month period, to take 13,000 submissions and integrate the views of the mass public into the debate, that itself was a challenge, which they pulled off.
Mm-hmm. So the public engagement, was that strong? How did people from the public respond during the process itself? Was there a social media element to it?
Oh, it was huge. And because this was such a big issue, this was the hot topic. You know, abortion was a very, very important topic for a country like ours. Mm-hmm. So there was a huge public engagement. The Twitter feed was massive. I saw the media feed, you know, the amount of newspaper journalists who were in the room. We had international media in the room, you know, from all countries who were observing it.
So the process is really about sifting through awareness, engaging with divergent viewpoints, coming back together, importantly, in a respectful environment, but also one that's open, as well as protecting those involved with it. And so then that gets handed up to the Parliament and the wishes of the people. How do you convince the Parliament that this really does reflect the wishes of the people when we are so committed to having a electoral process that is done in a ballot box or through referenda? Yeah. How do you convince a Parliament to do that, to accept it?
It's important that you get cross-party buy-in from the get-go. And that is what they did. So all the political parties were aware of it and to varying degrees were willing to support it. And so many of them would have followed it quite closely. But I think an aspect that is often underrated about processes like this is, after all, in the end, what it culminated in was a referendum vote. Are we going to allow abortion in the country? But it was so much more than the abortion vote, because what we needed to know when we were voting on that issue on voting day was what would be the legislation that would follow. Mm. So in fact, the biggest role played by the Citizens' Assembly was to talk about the kind of legislative regime that would follow. Under what circumstances would you allow abortion, for example? So they produced a whole series of recommendations, and that informed the political class, because that's the moment when you could see the politicians' little light switches going on, where they could begin to see, yeah, I might favour abortion under certain circumstances, but practically how would one legislate for those circumstances? And the Citizens' Assembly informed them about that.
We're talking with Professor David Farrell. He's an Irish political scientist from University College Dublin, and he was the research leader of the Irish Citizens' Assembly, which was really looking at this major question. I'm reminded of our Republican debate that happened in this country many decades ago now, actually. Mm. And part of the problem, it seemed, was that yes or no was the sort of blank question, but there wasn't any really clear process delineated or described for us as the public as to what would happen. Who would be our head of state if not the Queen? Mm-hmm. What would this preamble to the Constitution mean? What was the implications of making this kind of change with our international relations with other countries, etc.? So the groundwork wasn't laid, yeah, and people rejected it because they weren't certain of what exactly they were voting for. So your argument is that this process changes that.
Exactly. It's so, so important. And that was part of the bargain with the politicians. You know, this was clear from the beginning, that the recommendations of the Citizens' Assembly would be fed back into the parliamentary process to both inform whether or not to have the referendum, but more particularly to inform what kind of legislative underpinning would be provided later. So when we voted, we actually could see the draft legislation as voters. So I would be saying, if I had any say here for the Australian Republic vote, I would be saying, do the same thing. Have a Citizens' Assembly in advance, you know, decent time in advance. Allow that time and space for calm, reflective, informed discussion. You know, respectful discussion.
Calm, reflective, informed discussion.
Honestly, if you,
it's almost an absurd idea, isn't
it? It's the most incredible thing to observe. It really is. It's really uplifting. If you ever wanted to see democracy at its best, I'd strongly recommend stand in the back of a room when one of these things goes on. But then let that output be fed back into the parliament. And the deal then should be that the parliament, the Australian parliament, should decide on what kind of presidency they're going to go for before the referendum happens.
Have it all laid out. At least some options laid out for us. So obviously your neighbours across the Irish Sea have had a referendum recently with spectacularly disastrous results. Mm-hmm. Could you see that process that you've just described to us helping them out of it?
Yeah. Well, as it happens, 2 weeks ago, I was in London discussing that very thing. So there is a growing constituency of views. It may be too late because we're so close to the deadline for Brexit now. But there is a growing constituency of views that maybe there should be a second referendum. And this time, run it properly. This time, make it clear to the voters when they go to vote what Brexit really means.
Mm-hmm. So I'm sure that this isn't the only aspect of tinkering with the democracy that we use at the moment that you've thought about. What are some of your other ideas around maybe tweaking or reforming the democracy model that we have in our shared countries?
It's an interesting area because it just so happens last summer I was part of a group including New Democracy folk and people from other countries in East Belgium, discussing on the request of the German-speaking communities parliament in East Belgium a proposal for a permanent citizens' assembly. And I think it was two or three weeks ago, they've gone ahead and voted that through. So the German-speaking parliament in East Belgium have now set up a permanent citizens' assembly which will feed ideas and recommendations on a regular basis back into the parliamentary system.
How does it work?
Well, it could take a long time and I'd need pictures to probably show you. But the essence is that there will be a citizens' council, a random selection of regular citizens that will be in permanent operation, but its membership will rotate. So every 6 months, new people will join it and some people will drop off. And their job is to set an agenda. And they'll say, there's an issue that's come up and we think there should be a citizens' assembly, discuss this and make recommendations. So they then establish a citizens' assembly for that one particular purpose. Its recommendations then get fed back into the parliament. So it's not there to replace parliament. I think.
Well, that's the question, isn't it? Because aren't you just talking about having a whole lot of representatives there who don't actually have any policies or any demonstrated expertise in matters of civic importance?
The beauty of this is that you don't want the experts. You want the experts to provide the expertise to support and develop the knowledge base of these regular citizens. But you just want to hear regular citizens. The citizens are given voice. You know, the old-fashioned idea of democracy was that it's vote-centred. We vote and that's it. We kick the rascals out every 3 or 4 years. This is a new idea. It's voice-centred. So it's giving citizens the possibility to express their views in an informed way, and then it's fed back into the parliamentary process. And it needs a degree of respect given by the parliament back to a process like that. It shouldn't be ignored. And the Irish example shows that parliamentarians can do that if they really want to.
That respect you talk about being key to this sort of leads into my other question I wanted to ask you, and that is, what is the future for doing this online? What is the future for having much cheaper referenda where we could just have a snap vote on something when it comes up? We don't have to go to a ballot box. We don't have to go to the expense of engaging the Australian Electoral Commission on a full mass population vote. I mean, we'd still want everyone to vote. That would be important, I suppose. But, maybe not. Maybe that's another question. Yeah. But, you know, is there a future in that? Could it ever be respectful? Could it ever be trusted?
There's certainly a future for realising the potential of new technology to engage with citizens right across the country. There's some very good experiments being done in Iceland, for example, in Reykjavik. The city of Reykjavik uses new technology to invite the citizens of the city of Reykjavik to suggest proposals for how they'll spend part of the city budget. Mm-hmm. So, you know, among the proposals were, we need to spend more money on playgrounds. We need to locate playgrounds in certain areas, and therefore we need to allocate a budget line for that. So there's ways in which you can be inventive. You know, that's just one small municipal example. Mm-hmm. But you could imagine translating that on a grand scale. So technology is something that definitely is worth embracing here.
Mm-hmm. These are pretty crackerjack, exciting ideas, David Farrell. I'll watch with interest to see your country adopting them, and also whether ours will. I would love to see some of these practices, some of these ideas being implemented. Thank you very much for talking to us, and enjoy your time in Australia.
Thank you.
Professor David Farrell, Irish, as you can hear, from University College Dublin, and he was the research director of the Constitutional Convention, part of this Irish Citizens Assembly, which has informed their parliament about some significant ideas. And he's in Australia as a guest of the New Democracy Foundation, which engages with these ideas here in Australia. You can look them up online.